Thank you all for coming. I'm Dr. Teresa Harrison. I'm the Executive Director of Peaceful Paths. We are the certified domestic violence center that serves Alachua, Bradford, and Union counties here in North Central Florida. We've been around in this area providing services to adult and child.
Law enforcement, the judiciary, those kinds of things. The result of that has been that we have a very strong definition of domestic violence in this state. From the legal standpoint, domestic violence means any assault, battery, sexual battery, aggravated assault, stalking, aggravated stalking, kidnapping, false imprisonment, or any other criminal offense that results in the physical injury or death of one family or household member by another family or household member. Just this past year, we also added to this list as a felony, aggravated strangulation. So now, which choking, which is one of the most common forms of domestic violence injuries that we see, is now a forcible felony. In the past, it was a misdemeanor. So again, it's one of those things that we have been very good with our legislative lobbyists to help the legislature understand the importance of making these kinds of incidents a criminal activity. The key things to see in this definition that differ from many other states. First of all, Florida has defined domestic violence as occurring between family or household members. That includes people who have had a child in common, people who have lived together as if a family. That includes same-sex relationships, people who are related by blood or marriage. They also created another whole umbrella for dating violence, individuals who are involved in intimate partner relationships where there is no legal connection and they have not lived together. Those can still be considered domestic. That's a very important thing to realize in this state, because in many other states, the definition of domestic violence is still limited to people who are related by blood or legal marriage, which means that we don't capture a lot of statistics. It also means that there's not a lot of coverage for victims who lie outside those traditional bounds. In the state of Florida, we've recognized the family doesn't look like it did a generation ago. And we need to be prepared to understand that those intimate relationships are still impacting people from the standpoint of violence. When we talk about domestic violence from an advocacy perspective, and we take all of the legal terms out of it, we're really talking about patterns of coercive controlling behaviors that are designed to exert power and control over a person in an intimate relationship through tactics such as intimidation, threat, physical or psychological harm, or harassment. From an advocacy standpoint, the key things that we want people to understand about domestic violence is that it is a pattern. This is not a one-time fight gone bad. This is not about somebody having too much to drink and getting out of control, although that may exacerbate problems that are already existing. Domestic violence truly is about a cycle of power and control that one individual in the relationship, typically the male, uses to control the other individual in the relationship, typically the female. And we know that those patterns can utilize a variety of tactics. Most often it starts with emotional abuse, but it often ends up with the physical violence that you as physicians may see in the healthcare system. People coming in with a variety of symptoms that could all point back to the fact that this individual, this patient, could be a victim of domestic violence. When we talk about the characteristics of victims, we're talking primarily about women. Since the 1970s, the Department of Justice has been looking at the statistical reports regarding domestic violence and has been keeping track of how many reports are made each year, who makes them, where are they made, all of the kind of things that go along with that. And what they found is that over the course of the 30 years that they've been keeping statistics on domestic violence, the single thing that stays consistent is the fact that 90 to 95% of all victims are women. It's the only thing that links them together. Their socioeconomic status, their educational level, the geographic region of the country where they live, their racial or ethnic background, their religious affiliation, none of those things really have statistical linkage. The only thing that links victims together is the fact that 90 to 95% of them are women. Fear is the dominant motivation for the reason that they do the things that they do. When people ask the $64,000 question, why does she stay in a relationship, we say, well, she stays because she's afraid that if she leaves, there will be repercussions. And she has a very strong reason for fearing that. We know that, again, over the 30 years we've been keeping statistics from the National Department of Justice, what they have found is that women have a 7 to 10 times greater risk of becoming a victim of homicide once they leave a relationship than while they're in it. So leaving drastically increases a woman's risk of becoming a further victim of the batterer. It also increases her children's risk. It also increases the risks of the lives of her family and friends. Because typically once that relationship ends, the batterer's control has been broken, they don't have a whole lot to lose. And so that's when we see kind of the escalation of the lethality in those relationships. We also know through our statistical record keeping over the last 30 years that victims may also be victims of childhood abuse. This is one of those statistics that in the past was often used against victims because we would say, well, obviously there's something wrong with them, right? These women go out and they seek an individual who will belittle them, who will have domination over them, who will control them because there's something inherently wrong with them. What we really came to understand is it's not that there's something wrong with the victim, but if they were victims of childhood abuse, they go from being someone's bad daughter to someone's bad partner. So while they don't think it's normal, they do believe it's what they deserve. Because the one constant in their relationships is themselves. So it must be that, you know, I've always been a bad kid, that's why I was abused. Now I'm a bad partner, a bad wife, a bad mother. That's why my partner does these things to me. So again, it's not because there's something inherently wrong with the victim. They don't have a psychological disorder, and that's why they choose the partner that they choose. But they are very vulnerable to partners who are looking for someone to control because they've already been conditioned to believe that it's what they deserve. Victims also desperately want the abuse to end. In the years that I've been doing this work and in the years prior when I was working with abused kids, I never once had a victim come and tell me that, you know, the abuse stuff really just doesn't bother me. They all want it to stop. But women who are in situations of domestic violence often don't feel that they have the resources, the tools, the support system that's critical to making the choices they need to make for themselves and their children to end the abuse. And our society supports that. Our society victim blames. When we find out that a woman was in a situation of domestic violence, the first thing we say was, you know, well, why didn't she leave? The second question we ask is, well, you know, what's wrong with her? Why didn't she protect her kids? Then the third questions we start asking are things like, well, you know, what did she do to instigate this? Because as a society, we continue to have difficulty believing that individuals will engage in violent behavior by choice. And because we have difficulty believing that, we continue to blame victims. So it's easier for us as advocates to understand why women often feel that they have to stay in relationships because the societal support isn't there to help them remove themselves. From a healthcare standpoint, we often see women who develop chronic physical and mental health disorders as a result of the abuse. One of the more recent studies that came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association a few years ago looked at how victims of domestic violence related to victims who had suffered through wars. And what they found out is that children and adults who had lived through wars like the Bosnian conflicts, because that's the grouping of conflicts that they studied from the 90s, they found that those individuals had the exact same levels of PTSD and mental health disorders, anxiety-related disorders, as individuals who had lived through domestic violence. It's the same symptomology. It's women and children who really don't have the tools to heal themselves because they've been, as we say, beaten down a long time before they've been beaten up. So they're really in a situation where they have a variety of mental health and physical disorders that are related to the long-term chronic abuse. Victims often minimize or hide the abuse or deny the fact that they're victims. Again, when we go back to looking at how society treats victims, it's very easy to see why they do that. There's a lot of shame, there's a lot of guilt, There's a lot of blame that's placed on victims when they reveal that they are in situations where they're being victimized. We also know that our child welfare system oftentimes punishes the mother. We're really good at that. We like to take kids away from a mother who's being abused because she's failed to protect her children from the abuser. And then we set up visitation so he has more access to them. Does not make sense. But it's a really good reason why women don't often tell people that they're in situations where they're being abused. They're often reluctant to involve other people for a variety of reasons. It could be the shame and the guilt that goes along with being a victim. It could also be the fact that they're afraid that their abuser will then inflict the abuse onto those people that they tell. That's often a tactic that abusers use, that if you involve anyone else, you know, there will be repercussions, not only for you and for the children, but possibly for them. And finally, they may be unaware of resources. This happens a lot because of the way that we've defined domestic violence over the years. We're moving as an advocacy group away from the term domestic violence and moving more towards intimate partner violence. Partly because the term domestic violence has pretty much been associated with battered women, which is typically what we serve, battered women. And a lot of victims of domestic violence don't define themselves that way. A battered woman is somebody over there. She doesn't look like me. She doesn't have the same resources I have. So I don't know that I should be going to call the women's center, the battered women's shelter. But if we start talking about it in terms of intimate partner violence, and we start talking about it in terms of, yes, we're serving women. This is primarily a women's issue, a battered women's issue. But we start defining it in ways that women don't feel labeled. We're going to do a much better job of being able to present resources to them. When we talk about the characteristics of batterers, just as the justice statistics demonstrate to us that the vast majority of victims are women, the vast majority of perpetrators, somewhere between 95 and 97%, are male. And that's typically what we see in our center as well. The vast majority of people who are coming to us are in traditional heterosexual relationships where the male is the abuser and the female is the victim. That does not mean that we don't see female-on-male violence, male-on-male violence, and female-on-female violence. But it's kind of like snow in Florida. Female-on-male violence happens, but it's so rare that, you know, we just don't have to think about it that often. In the homosexual communities, we don't see a lot of reporting because, again, there's another societal stigma that surrounds homosexuality that often prevents victims from seeking services. But statistically, what we know over the last 30 years is that primarily batterers are men. They also engage in serial abuse, which means that just like the abuse is not a one-time incident in the relationship, this is typically not a one-time relationship for them. All of their relationships that involve intimacy typically involve some level of power and control. And we often find victims coming into shelter over the course of years that will tell us, you know, 6-7 individuals telling us the exact same name of their batterer, because this is the serial abuse that they engage in. Just as victims often minimize or deny the fact that the abuse is going on, batterers do the same thing. They deny that they're abusive. They minimize what's happening in the relationship. They'll say things to their victims like, well, it's not like you had to go to the hospital. It's not like you needed stitches. It's not like there was blood. Right? Or, you know, come on, stop crying. It wasn't that bad. We also know that the denial is a big piece of the relationship, and we've had women tell us things like, you know, there'll be an incident in the evening, maybe after bedtime, where my partner will hit me, and in the morning I'll get up and I have this black eye, and he comes to the table and says, what happened to you? And she says, well, you know, what do you mean, what happened to me? I mean, you hit me. I didn't hit you. And it goes back to this, you know, I'm going to distort reality in such a way that then you begin questioning yourself. Well, maybe you didn't hit me. Did I get drunk? You know, did I drink too much? Did I take a pill and fall down and not know what happened to me? And batterers will use those tactics, again, to minimize, deny, and oftentimes keep the victim in a state of chaos where they won't really know what reality is. Batterers also disregard legal consequences, which in 2007, you would think there would be more of them, but unfortunately, we're still in a society where you can get more time for beating your dog, driving on a suspended license, carjacking, and minor burglary than you can for beating your wife. And in fact, in our society, the first line of defense for a victim of domestic violence is a civil order of protection, which is a piece of paper. It doesn't do a whole lot to support you as a victim. It also has to be backed up by law enforcement. And we know that our law enforcement officers are often overtaxed. We know that our judiciary is often overstressed. And many times women just don't feel like the process is even worth going through. So we have a situation where there just aren't that many legal consequences for battering. And so it supports the idea that the batterer has a right to do this. Batterers often have a strong sense of self-confidence and ego. The idea, again, that they have the right to do this. This is their privilege as a male, as the leader of this household. They'll often display an attitude of ownership over their partner and their children. They use societal traditions like the fact that the woman takes his name when they get married as a way to say, well, now I own you. These kids have my name, they're my kids. You're living in my house, eating my food. They'll often use religious traditions to say, well, I am the designated head of the household, therefore I have the right to fill in the blank. And that goes along with the ideas of male privilege or social status to justify the abuse, that no one's going to believe you because of who I am. I have this persona, I have this reputation, and therefore I can get away with things because everybody's going to look at you and think you're nuts because that's what I'm going to tell them. And the reality is that all of these tactics are often used against battered women in a way that keeps them in a relationship because they don't feel that there are options for them. Any questions to this point? So what do the dynamics of these relationships look like? Well, again, they're characterized by power and control and the patterns of power and control that are used. They frequently involve or start with emotional abuse, things like using the children as pawns, intimidating the victim, isolating the victim, threatening the pets, all of those things to exert control. And then we see this cycle that keeps victims both fearful and hopeful that change or escape is possible. One of the things that victims tell us oftentimes is that, yes, they want to leave the person, but then they'll see these glimpses throughout the cycle of violence of the person that they fell in love with. And we talk a lot to our younger women who are dating. We say, you know, people don't fall in love with bad people. They fall in love with people they don't know everything about. And so it's very important for us to understand that women who get involved in these relationships, at one point, their abuser was not the person that they are now. They presented something very different. And so it's very hard for us from the outside to look and say, well, I would just leave. We know lots of people who are in unhealthy relationships that may not involve violence, but that may not be positive, who may stay because of mortgages and kids and social status. And victims stay for all of those reasons, plus they had the added dimension that they are afraid. So how often does this happen in the United States? Well, unfortunately, it's almost impossible for us to say with any accuracy how many incidents of domestic violence actually occur in the United States every year for a variety of reasons. The first one is that there is this societal stigma about reporting. Women don't talk about it. They don't talk about it to their physicians. They don't talk about it to their friends. They definitely don't talk about it to police. We know that about 1 in 10 incidents of domestic violence is ever reported to the police. 1 in 10. We also know that even when it is reported, because of the varying definitions of domestic violence across the country, we don't always count it as domestic violence. We don't always count it as domestic violence in this area. As I said at the beginning, we serve Alachua, Bradford, and Union County. In Alachua County, we have, on average, somewhere between 1,700 and 2,000 arrests for domestic violence every year. In Bradford County, it's around 100, which they only have 25,000 people, so that seems reasonable. Union County, we went 3 years without having any incidents of domestic violence reported between 1998 and 2001, and it's not because they found the cure. And last year, we only had 27 incidents of domestic violence reported in Union County. Anybody want to take a guess at why? Correctional Institute. Very good. Their number one employer in Union County is the Rayford Correctional Institute. And if you are charged in the state of Florida with a felony domestic violence count, what is the judge by law obligated to do? Remove your weapons. So if they remove your weapons and you are a correctional officer, you cannot go to work. So they just don't say it's domestic violence. So the varying definitions of domestic violence across the country, the way it's applied, all of those things skew our statistics. But what we do know is even with the bad reporting and the varying definitions, that it's somewhere between 960 and 3.9 million incidents of domestic violence every year. And because only 1 in 10 report, it could be as high as 40 million. There were an estimated 3.8 million victims of family violence between 1998 and 2002 that were in the system. In the system, that means that they entered either child welfare, the judiciary, law enforcement. We know that domestic violence crimes were reported only, again, about 60% of the time to anybody. And of those that were reported to police, only 36% of them resulted in any type of arrest. According to a 2001 study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which I have trouble saying, approximately 20% of the women who died during pregnancy were murdered. The number one cause of death among pregnant women. But that study only looked at 15 states. Because in the other 35, including the state of Florida, it does not say on the death certificate whether or not the woman was pregnant at the time of death. So those rates could be much higher. But again, it's information that traditionally we've not considered important. So we don't keep statistics on. When we look at studies that involve the consequences of physical and psychological harm, we see that in this study they found that of the women studied, and these were individuals who had been involved in some sort of incident that led to intervention by some in some manner, 56% of the women who experienced the intimate partner violence were eventually diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder. 29% of them attempted suicide. 37% of them had symptoms of depression. 46% had symptoms of anxiety disorder. And 45% experienced post-traumatic stress disorder. Long-term health repercussions for women that are involved in intimate partner violence. So let's talk quickly about the myths, because these are the things that kind of, again, uphold domestic violence tolerance in our society. The fact that we don't talk about it, we kind of, you know, want to slough it off to it being bad decision-making on the part of the woman or environmental factors on the part of the man. But what we know is that there are three main myths that uphold domestic violence in our society. The first is that victims of domestic violence have psychological disorders, and that's why they're victims, right? We victim blame. We say, well, there's obviously something wrong with her that she chooses this person over and over and over again in her life, and that's why she's a victim. Whereas if we look at it from the other side of that coin, the reality is that batterers are the ones who are going out with a laundry list in their head of who they want. Somebody that's easy to control, somebody who's a little more vulnerable, maybe doesn't have a lot of experience, somebody who would never believe that the person that they're falling in love with would hurt them. So that's one big myth. The second big myth has to do with batterers. And that is that batterers abuse their partners or their spouses because of things like alcohol or substance abuse, stress, or unemployment. So let's break those down. If we talk about batterers who have substance abuse or alcohol problems, and we say that that's why they batter, then it stands to reason that if we treat a batterer with a substance or an alcohol problem, the battering should go away. But what we know is the reality is all we get is a sober batterer. Substance abuse can definitely exacerbate violence in a relationship, but it is not the cause. Because if you look at countries where alcoholism and substance abuse are not issues, like many places in the Middle East, then it would stand to reason that battering wouldn't be issues there. And that's not the case. We also know that in incidents, they've actually done studies where they looked at did a higher number of liquor stores in a neighborhood increase the amount of domestic violence that was being reported? There was no link. Imagine that. Okay? Let's talk about it in terms of stress. Domestic violence caused by stress. If that were the case, every single relationship in this country, every single relationship in the world would have intimate partner violence as part of it. Because we all experience stress in one way or another. Can stress exacerbate battering? Yes. It's why we see during hurricanes, during times of natural disaster, hotline calls increase. It's why we see the request for shelter increase. Because stress causes those relationships where battering is present, it's just another excuse. Now there's something else going wrong that I can blame you for. If it were about unemployment, then it would stand to reason that during times of economic recession, we would see higher incidence of domestic violence than during times of economic growth. We don't see that. There is no pattern that follows it. It would also stand to reason that in parts of the country where there is economic recession kind of ongoing, like West Virginia would have a much higher rate of domestic violence than, say, New York. Not the case. So we know that unemployment, while again, financial problems can exacerbate the problem of domestic violence, it is not the cause. Because if it were, it wouldn't happen among rich people, it would only happen among poor people. And that's not the case. And all of these go back to the fact that the biggest myth and the one that's the most destructive is the one that we tend to believe the most, and that is that violent behavior is not a choice. We are a society that loves simple solutions to complex problems. And all you have to do is watch, you know, nighttime television for a couple of hours and count the number of pharmaceutical ads that you see. Flip through a magazine. Count the number of print ads for pharmaceuticals that you see. And every single one of them will say, if you have this, 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 and this, take this pill. You want to cure obesity? Take this. You want to cure smoking? Take this. You have depression? Take this. And we don't often look at the bigger symptoms. We want to do the same thing with domestic violence. We want to say that battering is obviously something wrong with that particular individual that we could potentially cure. Maybe they have intermittent explosive disorder. That was one of the ideas that was put forth in the 1980s. Intermittent explosive disorder. They have this disorder. It only happens between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. while they're at home. Maybe they have anger management issues. Absolutely not. Batterers who are sent to anger management, it just makes them better batterers because they obviously have good anger management. They manage their anger in such a way that they don't allow it to be seen by anybody but their intimate partner. We've had all kinds of theories put forth. You know, we've had studies done where by legitimate groups. We've had journalism on the subject where they said, well, you know, in the Northeast or in the Northwest, excuse me, more women go to shelter during hunting season than any other time of the year. So it's obvious that something about hunting makes men more violent and then they beat their wives. And what we said is, no, let's look at the reality of the hunting culture in the Northwest. They don't go hunting in the Northwest like they do in Florida, where you pack up the stuff in the morning, go sit in a deer stand for 2 days and come home. They go to a camp for like 6 weeks. So as soon as the batterer leaves, mom's got access to the kids and access to resources that she may not have any other time of the year. So, of course, we see more women coming to shelter during hunting season than any other time. A few years ago, the Atlanta Journal did a series of stories about the fact that there are more women in shelter during the summer in the South than any other time of the year. So what do you think the brilliant deduction of that journalist was? Because it's hot. So we can cure domestic violence with a box fan. The reason that more women come to shelter during the summer than any other time of the year in a lot of places, not just the South, is because school is out. And when your kids aren't in school, your batterer doesn't have access to going and getting them every day, which is a big fear for a lot of women. My kids go to school, and then he's going to pick them up at the end of the day, and I'm not going to know where they are. In the summer, I have access to them. The other thing is they're not fighting the kids as much. Kids don't want to necessarily leave school and their friends and all the other things. But in the summer when they're not involved in all of those social activities, it's a lot easier to convince them, look, mom needs to do this. We need to do this as a family. And then the biggest and probably the most egregious journalistic error ever. In the 1980s, when the Dallas Cowboys were doing really well, and there was an upcoming Super Bowl to be held in Dallas, an AP reporter wrote that the number one day that women in America are abused is Super Bowl Sunday. Have you ever heard that one? Anyway, okay, good. Maybe it's dying. I shouldn't talk about it anymore. Maybe it'll go away completely. But again, the idea took hold. And people said, oh, well, obviously. More women are beaten on Super Bowl Sunday than any other because football makes people crazy. And games like last week, I could agree with that. However, I've not got so angry at a football game than I've taken it out by beating my husband. Or the other way around. The stuffed gator, I'm not talking about him. But again, it goes back to we want a simple solution. We want to be able to say, well, it's because we have a violent culture. We let them watch violent football, and then they beat their wives. Or we let them engage in violent video games, and then they beat their wives. And the reality is they beat their wives, they beat their partners, because they can't. Because we as a society have not stepped up to say, if you engage in intimate partner violence, there will be consequences. Instead, we send them to a 26-week batterer intervention program, which is designed to undo however many years of choice behavior they've been engaging in. Now, what's the number one health problem in America that's choice-related? Smoking, right? Smoking. And we know that you can't even get somebody to quit smoking in 26 weeks. But yet we want to say a 26-week batterer intervention program will change this individual's world paradigm. Right? Not only will you stop engaging in violent behavior, you're no longer going to think that males have privilege to do those things and that your wife is equal to you. And you're going to start operating on a relationship based on respect instead of one based on power and control. Ridiculous. But it goes back to the fact that is until we as a society come together to say that intimate partner violence is wrong, it's criminal behavior, and we're going to treat it with consequences that are equal to its level of impact in our society, we're going to continue to say, well, it's not really choice. It's because maybe they were abused as kids, or it's violent behavior in the violent TV, or the heat, or hunting culture, or whatever. Yes.
The question is the family, like taking both parts and trying to figure things out. Because as you're talking, I mean, this is very easy. Put the batters in prison and separate people, and that's it. And this would be fixed.
I'm not sure that we're saying that they should all be sent to prison. I'm saying that there should be more consequences than what there are. For example, California has a 2-year batterer program. We have 26 weeks. I mean, I think that we could extend the length of the time that they're in those kinds of programs. I think that we could improve the curriculum that's taught. Right now, it's a psychoeducational program. It should be licensed, trained therapists that are in there actually working with them to help them understand, and not just anybody who wants to get certified as a batterer intervention provider. In this county, we're very lucky because we have excellent batterer intervention providers, Dr. Paul Wheeler and Butch Jones, who do a phenomenal job. But they're two individuals. And when you're talking 1,700 to 1,900 arrests, there's just no way. So I think that we do, as an organization, try to look at what the woman wants. We don't want women coming to us and being afraid to talk to us because they think we're going to tell them you got to get a divorce or you got to leave your partner. We don't say that. If she says she wants to stay, we say, okay, how can we help you stay safe? How can we help you get the tools that you need to understand this cycle of violence and to have a safe place to go, to have the support system that you need. But I think that overall as a society, we want to say, well, let's just send them to couples counseling, and that'll fix it. And what we know is that if you send relationships that are involved in intimate partner violence to couples counseling, all of those tactics of power and control are just going to carry over. So we really have to treat them separately, and hopefully eventually, if he makes changes, they could come back together. But the way our system is set up, with no jail time at all, no long-term probation consequences at all, he still gets access to his kids. I mean, that happens all the time. And that's where really we have a breakdown in the kind of consequences that we give. Because if you get an injunction against you as the male, as the perpetrator, you can say, yeah, I've been violent towards my wife, but I still want to see my kids. And the judge is likely going to give you visitation. Because we haven't come to terms yet with the fact that if you're a batterer, you can't be a good dad. Those two things are mutually exclusive. So, you know, we still tend to think that parental rights override safety. And that's simply not the case. 60 to 70% of the men who beat their wives beat their kids. But we don't take that access away. So again, it's the consequences that really are the issue. It's not about prison, it's about consequences that matter. Consequences that work. All right, so as healthcare providers, what are some things that you can look at, signs of violence that you can look at for in patients that hopefully will help you identify better those victims that are coming to you for unstated problems? Well, again, just like we talk about with child abuse, you're going to look for physical, sexual, and emotional signs, things like bruises, people who are very anxious, if there's bite marks or STDs, all of those could be red flags. When we talk about identifying victims, 92% of the women in this study that was done, again, Journal of the American Medical Association, 92% of the women said that they never talked to their primary care physician about the violence in their life. And on the flip side, only 10% of physicians said they routinely screen for it. So physicians don't ask, victims and patients don't tell. So it's important that we all start creating that environment where victims feel safe to reveal the violence. So how do you do that? Well, it's your responsibility to ask those tough questions. And it's pretty easy to do because you don't have to come directly out and ask every patient necessarily. You can put it on the intake form. You know, every time a patient comes to a doctor's office, they're given that intake form that says, since your last visit or if you are a new patient, have you ever experienced any of the following? And there's like 400 things, right, that you get to check. And you can easily put a box on there that says, has anyone in your home ever hurt you? Have you ever been a victim of intimate partner violence? Don't say, are you a battered woman? Because they won't check that box. They don't want to be labeled. But asking, has anyone in your home ever hurt you? Are any of the symptoms that you're coming for care today, have any of them been caused by someone in your home? Key question. And again, it gives the patient the opportunity to check that box, feel that it's a safe environment to reveal those things. The whole screening process takes less than 5 minutes. You are going to look for red flags. If you see those red flags, you're going to ask some good questions, make a referral, and then finally, and most critically, send that positive message. Red flags for you to look for. If the patient comes in and complains of chronic pain, has multiple injuries, patterns of injuries, again, just like we screen for in child abuse. If they have a poor contraceptive history, they have multiple or unwanted pregnancies, if they have poor self-care, if their partner comes with them and acts in an overprotective manner, you ask her the question, he gives you the answer, or she looks at him for permission before she answers, that's always a big red flag. And we have some really good kind of sneaky ways to get him out of the room if he's not cooperative. We always use the, our copier ate your insurance card one, right? We made a copy of your insurance card, but we can't see it, so could you please come out to the front desk so we can make another copy? Anything to get them out of the room for 3 minutes. Again, if they have anxiety, if they're substance abuse apparent, all of those things could be red flags. How do you initially screen? Well, again, including those questions about past abuse on your intake forms is a really good and easy way to do that screening. And if the patient, once they check the box, gets into the exam room and says, oh, no, I don't want to talk about this, it's really easy for them to say, oh, I'm sorry. I meant to check the box for migraine. I just made a mistake. Or I didn't mean to check yes there. I meant to check no. But ask directly about forced sexual activity in the past. Again, if you've got a married woman in your practice, that comes in as a patient, she may not answer, have you ever been raped? with a yes, because she's going to look at consensual relations with her husband means that he can never rape her. So again, asking about have you ever been forced to have sex against your will, very different question. Using specific descriptions to indicate the types of abuse that may have occurred. A lot of women will come to us and say, well, he doesn't actually hit me. You know, he doesn't hit me with his closed fist. Now, he kicks me, he pulls my hair, he's burned me, he's strangled me, he's thrown things at me. Again, be very descriptive, because these women are trying to survive, and so they compartmentalize, they minimize, they deny. He doesn't actually hit me. He does all this other stuff, but there's no actual hitting. Allow patients to mark on a body map areas where they've been hurt. We do this exercise with women as they come into shelter. We give them a body map and say, you know, record all the places where you've been injured by your partner. And a lot of times this could be over a 10-year relationship or longer. And there may only been one physical incident every year or so. But when they put them all together, it makes a very different picture for them, where they start to say, wow, this really is a potentially serious and lethal situation. And then, of course, asking them about the number of times that they've sought medical care for the injury. So if they check the box, and then you want to start asking some questions, there are framing questions that you can ask. Questions that don't specifically point to that patient, but say, you know what, this is just something that I ask about with everybody. Like I ask, do you smoke? Now I ask, you know, there's such a prevalence of family violence that I ask all my patients about it. Some of the women I treat have this issue, and they're afraid to talk about it, so I've just started to ask. Some of the gay and lesbian patients I treat are often hurt by their partners. Has your partner ever hurt you? So again, it's not pointing directly at that patient, but it's giving that patient an opening to say, yes, this is a problem. Yes, and you are a safe individual to talk to. And then if they answer yes to any of those questions, there are direct questions that you can follow up with. Things like, has your partner ever threatened or hurt you? Do they ever threaten or hurt your kids? Has someone caused your injuries? If yes, who? Can you tell me who it was? Are you afraid of your partner? Are you afraid to leave today? Can I call someone to help? And all of these questions, which is really, they're really great conversation starters with patients, are all available on the Family Violence Prevention Fund website, which is endabuse.org. And it's a great website. They have all kinds of physician-related materials, and all of them are free. And then once you have a patient who has revealed that this is an issue for them, it's important to make a referral. It's why I brought some of the materials I brought today. We have posters that you can put in your exam rooms, in your restrooms, that have tear-offs. These allow patients to take our number with them in a very unobtrusive way. We'll get you as many of these as you need. We also have brochures that you can put in your lobby. It's important for people that are in the waiting room or in the exam room. If they see this, they begin to say, well, maybe this is a safe environment for me to reveal what's really going on in my life. It's important to never pressure patients. All of us get into these kinds of careers because we want to help. And so it's hard for us sometimes to take that step back from saying you need to, you should, you must. But when it comes to domestic violence, we have to trust that victims know when the time is right for them to make decisions about their relationship. So what we can do is provide them with the necessary resources, to provide them with the support. Discuss what options are available to them, know what options are available in the community, and then make those referrals. And then finally, we want to send a positive message. It takes a lot of courage for a victim to come forward and say, this is what the cause of my healthcare issues are. So it's important to validate their feelings. It's important to reassure them that it's not their fault. You may be the very first person in that individual's life to say that, you know what, nobody deserves to hurt. And you have the right to live without fear and violence. So if you can send those messages to patients, it oftentimes reinforces that they've made the right decision to talk to their physician about it and that there is going to be some light at the end of the tunnel. Okay. That concludes the lecture portion of what I've got to present to you. So we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. If there are any questions, yes. Thank you. Outstanding. Outstanding. And we appreciate that. Anybody that will put that on their intake screening, it's such a critical piece, especially if you do OBGYN. We recommend that you screen at every prenatal visit. Dr. Kellner's wonderful, so I'm sure he's got everybody trained in doing those. So.
Any other comments or questions for Dr. Harrison?
Yes.
Qualifications, you know, we have to have this periodically as doctors, but for instance, lawyers have
to be. Judicial training is a sticky point. No, law enforcement does. Law enforcement officers have to go through it both at the academy, and then once they're a sworn officer, every 2 years they're required to at least have a 4-hour block of domestic violence. Judicial training and legal training, it's not required, and it's very difficult to get that into the books. But we try every year. We push the bill every year, and it always gets shot down. Absolutely, especially because with our judiciary, when a new judge is elected in a circuit, their first assignment is always the family bench. And it's the most difficult, and everybody hates to do it. That's why they put the newbie there. And they're often very, very inexperienced. And it's very critical that they have this information because they're making life or death decisions for people every day. And they have a lot of discretion when it comes to civil jurisdiction, whether to send it to mediation, whether to give visitation or not, whether to grant all of those things. The family court judge can make based off of one petition for an injunction and a 10-minute hearing. So it's important that they have the training. Absolutely.
Questions for Dr. Harrison?
If not, please take the materials and let us know if we can provide any more.